In part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this part of the program, we'll be looking at the development of media here in the United States and looking at how it is that it worked out the way that it did, and particularly looking at the differences between American media and media in other countries, particularly in Europe. And there certainly are very important differences. And here we're, by the way, we're defining media rather broadly in the sense that we are including the broadcast media, radio and television, but also things like the telephone, the telegraph, newspapers, and books. And it is, as you look at it and as we'll discuss, very different here in the United States from France, from Britain. And our guest for the program this morning would make the argument that that is not an accident, that those differences of the way the media developed in the United States were the result of deliberate political decisions. Our guest is Paul Starr. He is professor of sociology at Princeton, and he is co-editor of The American Prospect. He's authored a book which looks at this subject that we'll be discussing. It's titled The Creation of the Media, and the subtitle is Political Origins of Modern Communications, and covers the period roughly from early America to the eve of World War II. The book is published by Basic Books, is out now in bookstores, and has gotten a lot of positive attention, as did an earlier book, a book that he won the Pulitzer Prize for. This was in 1984, a book titled The Social Transformation of American Medicine. It won the Pulitzer in 84 for general nonfiction, also won the Bancroft Prize in American History. As we talk with Paul Starr, questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's certainly good anywhere that you can hear us. And if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Starr, hello.
Good to be with you this morning, David.
Well, thank you for talking with us. We appreciate it. And just, again, to restate the basic point up front, you're making the argument that when you look at the differences, and there are important differences in the way that media developed in the United States, you compare that with most other places, certainly countries in Britain and in Europe, there are important differences. And those differences, they didn't come about by accident.
No, they stem from the basic political framework of the United States, as well as from very specific decisions that go back to the founding of the Republic, including not only the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights, but also originally the way the postal system worked, which had very important effects on newspapers, and later on key choices that were made about the telegraph, telephone, broadcasting, and so forth. These were choices that created the basic institutions of the media. And my argument is that these choices set those media off on a different path of development in the United States. This is the story, I argue, of an American triumph and an American dilemma. The triumph is that the media flourished in the United States. This has been a source of a very innovative industry, of economic growth, I argue even military advantage for the United States. But on the other hand, it's also the source of a great dilemma, because the media have grown tremendously powerful as a result of these choices. And so on the one hand, the media are supposed to be the people's guardian against abuses of power in the government. But when the media themselves become very powerful, and when their control becomes highly concentrated, and when they bend the law to their own advantage, then we have a problem that we don't have a ready solution for.
Hmm. Well, after we've talked a little bit about the material that's in the book, maybe I would ask you to talk about where we are today.
Sure.
Go past this point, which I suspect probably there will be another book. I don't know if you're thinking about doing something from World War II on. But in any case, let me just come back to one point, which you have touched on, but I think that it also is an important point that you make, and that is that by virtue of the decisions that were made in this country and the way that communications developed, that the United States was, before it was a world power in any other respect, economically, militarily, what have you, it was a leader in communications. And I think that you're also arguing that that paved the way for future American dominance in other areas.
Yes, yes, I do. If you go back, let's say, to 1830, which is really before the Industrial Revolution in America, it's before a significant technological change in any of the media. It happened to be that year was the year that Alexis de Tocqueville visited the United States. And he was struck by the tremendous abundance of newspapers in America. He describes visiting what were then frontier areas in Tennessee, Kentucky, and Michigan, and his amazement at finding newspapers being carried along on a mail coach and being dropped off in the wilderness. And he said, these Americans, they go into the wilderness with their Bibles, their axes, and their newspapers. But why did that happen? That didn't happen just because of American character. It's because the United States set up a postal system that carried those newspapers out there, that carried them at a tremendous discount, in fact. Newspapers were given bargain rates, and that was for a political reason. The founders of the country were very worried that the republic would not hang together, that it would fall apart. And they saw the postal system, and they saw newspapers as one way to encourage a greater connection among Americans, and particularly a connection that would allow members of Congress, the political parties, to communicate with their constituents. Because that's what newspapers were primarily political in those days. And so it had a kind of nation-building purpose behind it, and it resulted in, I mean, we now have fairly good data, and it looks like in 1830, when Tocqueville was here, that the United States had three times the newspapers per capita as England, and much higher rate than any other country. So it was the already at that point, newspapers had taken off. Book publishing was taking off. The postal system was much more extensive. And it's really no surprise, then, that the telegraph and then the telephone also developed much more quickly. And the United States made, of course, crucial contributions to both of those technologies at a time when, again, the United States was not really a technological leader.
Hmm. Let's take a step back and talk about the relationships between early American media and the Revolution. You certainly make the point that if the way people think about the Revolution, they have something, they think it has something to do with taxes and with lack of representation and those two things. But I think what you encourage people to think about is that for printers in the United States before the Revolution, that they did not face the kind of restrictions that European printers did. It was easy to print and to circulate inexpensive newspapers and pamphlets, and Americans got used to that. And so when the British came around to instituting the stamp tax in 1765, then what that meant was that printers had to pay a tax on every sheet of paper they printed. And because people had gotten used to a very different kind of environment without that kind of restriction, they got mad about that.
Right.
And so one can say that, yes, it was about taxation and representation, but it was also about access to ability to circulate printed material.
Yes. The stamp tax was one of the events, of course, that led to the Revolution, and it was specifically the event that politicized the printers. Before that point, by and large, printers had tried to stay neutral in political controversy. They were not immediately the allies of the patriots who were protesting British taxation, but when the tax hit them, of course, it set them off, and it was the beginning of a very close relationship between the revolutionary cause and the newspapers. And it's my argument that it's partly out of that experience of the revolutionary period that freedom of the press became such a high political value, that it kind of crystallized at that point. And so freedom of the press was recognized actually first in several of the state constitutions, even before the Bill of Rights. And that was part of the transformation. Another aspect of that is that the precedent was set in the United States that there would be no taxes on the press. And interestingly enough, that has actually continued throughout our history. There's been no special taxation of the press. There have been some very minor state taxes, but on the whole, communication in the United States has received a very privileged position in relation to taxation.
So here we see this this alliance between the printers and the revolutionaries leading to this idea that survived the revolution, that freedom of the press was a core value.
Yeah.
Together we have also with that the important institution that grew in this period, which was the postal system. And and it was important because it dramatically increased the reach of media, giving them a special rate.
Let me also mention one other aspect of that here, which is that newspaper printers could exchange copies with other printers, exchange copies of their newspapers for free through the postal system. And in the early Republic, this is before the telegraph, the post office was essentially the news network. It was the backbone for communication from one area of the country to another. And so, if you look at it, what the government was doing was underwriting the creation of this free news network without controlling the content of the news. That is, all newspapers were entitled to this. There was no discretion. Post offices, postmasters could not select among newspapers. And that was really an extraordinary stance for a government to take in relation to the press at that time in history. Because if you want to go back now to the contrast to Europe, the European states heavily taxed the press. They censored the press. And specifically in the case of the post office, they decided which newspapers could go through the postal system. So in all those respects, the United States set off in a dramatically different direction. Yeah.
Just also one other thing that's worth mentioning, and you certainly do discuss, is the, at least in the northern part of the United States, public education and a fairly high rate of literacy.
Yes, that's true, and I'm glad you mentioned the fact that this is different between North and South, because although the postal policies were the same throughout the country, there was a tremendous difference in the development of literacy, in the development of educational institutions and other institutions, and those advanced much, much faster in the North and the Midwest than they did in the South. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Paul Starr. He is professor of sociology at Princeton University. He's the author of the book, The Creation of the Media, Political Origins of Modern Communications. It's published by Basic Books. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In the next major section of the book, you're taking on another very large chunk of time, roughly from the Civil War to 1930, where we see the development of telegraph, telephone, and then also radio. And again here, there is in all of these cases, there is a very important difference between the United States and Europe, and that is, in the United States, all of these things were developed by private companies, and in Europe, they were controlled by the government.
Yes. What I emphasize there is that at the very beginning of this process, this goes back actually to the mid-1840s when the decision was made about the telegraph, it actually could have gone either way. For example, in 1844, this was after the first telegraph line had been demonstrated to be effective. This was between Washington and Baltimore, and And the federal government had paid for that, and Samuel F. B. Morse, the inventor of the telegraph, wanted to sell out his patent rights to the federal government. There were many people who supported that. In the 1844 election, one of the candidates for president, Henry Clay, the candidate of the Whig Party, favored nationalizing the telegraph. But he lost the election. He lost the election to James Polk, the Democrats, and they were against it. And as a result, the telegraph developed on a private basis. But once that choice was made, it set things off on a different direction in the United States. So that when the choice came about the telephone, the model had already been established, and the United States also opted for private development. Meanwhile, in Europe, things went in the opposite direction. And here, it doesn't have anything to do with socialism. It has to do with the role of the military, actually, much more. Because the first telegraph actually was not the electric telegraph. There was an earlier kind of telegraph that hardly anybody knows about. This was a visual telegraph system that was initially established by the French and that grew under Napoleon. And it was a system of relay towers with kind of windmill-like devices on top. And the position of the arms indicated which words were being transmitted according to a code. And the French had set this up for their armies. And so the first telegraph systems that developed in Europe had developed as a means of military communication. And the state completely controlled this development. It was thought to be too important for national security. And so when the electric telegraph came along in the 1840s, the Europeans tended to look at it just the same way, too important to leave to any kind of private organization. And so the governments took over the telegraph. And that kind of channeled their development in a very different direction from the United States. That got reproduced with the telephone, got reproduced with broadcasting, and ended up creating a whole state communication sector that didn't really develop in the United States beyond the original post office. Hmm.
There, in the story of the telegraph and the telephone, it seems that there is an important difference in this respect. While they both were monopolies, the telegraph was an unregulated monopoly, and the telephone system, after a very brief period where there was some competition when Bell's patent expired, it also became a monopoly, but it was a regulated monopoly. What led to the difference in the way the government thought about those two things, telephone and telegraph?
Well, okay, so the telegraph first developed in the 1840s, and there was actually a very competitive telegraph industry for about 20 years, with at one point more than 50 different telegraph companies. But the very nature of that business is that the dominant network will have much lower costs than smaller networks and will be a much better system to use. And the result is there develops a kind of a tipping point in network competition. And we've seen this in other industries happen as well. And so we went from competition to monopoly. In the telegraph industry, one company emerged, Western Union. It was actually the first national monopoly of any kind in the United States. This is in 1866. Mm-hmm. And so we had no antitrust law at that time. We had no legal tradition for dealing with this kind of concentrated private power. We were really unprepared. There was actually an effort to nationalize Western Union in the 1860s and 70s. But Western Union had an alliance with the dominant newspapers in the country that controlled the Associated Press. And in fact, this is why the Western Union monopoly was such a dangerous monopoly so far as free communication is concerned, because it really involved not just a monopoly on the telegraph wire, but a monopoly on the distribution of national news. And the AP really, at that point, was a monopoly news service. No other news service could get access to Western Union, and therefore no other news service could compete with AP. This is in the late 19th century. And AP manipulated its power. There's a very interesting case involving the 1876 election, which bears some similarities to the 2000 election. This is an election where the candidate who didn't win the popular vote ended up winning the election as a result of a political decision, not the Supreme Court in this case, but a decision by a congressional commission. And it's clear that AP and Western Union played a role in throwing that election to the Republican candidate. So that's why, I mean, you know, telegraph precedes the antitrust laws. The telephone got started in the 1870s. At first there was a patent monopoly. That is, Alexander Graham Bell had a patent for the telephone that gave the Bell Telephone Company total control over the early development of the telephone. Then in the 1890s, the patents came to an end, and there exploded in the United States a great variety of different telephone companies. This is actually a fascinating episode in the history of communication because there developed thousands of little cooperatives in the United States, many in rural areas, small towns, that started up service on a very limited basis, but the Bell Company hadn't been interested in them. They weren't profitable enough. And so Americans, in effect, took the process into their own hands. And the telephone advanced much more rapidly in the United States during that period than before. So we had, again, this is typical of all the media, but telephones, I think, a really interesting case, much more rapid diffusion of this technology. But there emerged a problem, and that is in many cities there were two different unconnected telephone systems. So you might have a telephone and somebody else you wanted to speak to had a different kind of telephone and you couldn't call them. And that became quite a nuisance, as you can imagine. After a while, people got fed up with this. And support for regulation grew up partly because of this system. So, again, competition had its limitations. And people around the country, this was primarily at the state level, eventually it involves the federal government, opted for regulation in the telephone industry.
I just found myself wondering whether you think that policymakers, when telephone industry was developing, they looked back at what had happened with the telegraph, and did they think, well, we should not let this, we should exercise a little bit more control than we did in that case.
Yes, I think there was. In fact, the people who were involved in the early development of Bell Telephone included some of the most prominent critics of the Western Union monopoly. And the telephone was really seen by some of its supporters, some of the people involved in introducing it, as a way of getting around the Western Union monopoly. So the telephone was in some ways itself a rival to the telegraph. And it's actually, I think, very important historically that Western Union did not get control of the telephone. It almost did, actually. There was a period when it stood on the verge of dominating the telephone industry, but again, there was a key legal decision that resulted in Bell emerging as a separate company, and the competition between the two was very important.
When we come to radio, again, we see that the pattern now has been established to allow private industry to take these technologies and run with them, perhaps with some government regulation. And again, here the big difference in radio between the United States and Europe is that here in the United States, radio is a private industry. It's funded by selling advertising, which I guess in the early days of radio was something of a controversial question. And then if you compare that with Europe, there, Britain and Europe, you have government-run systems that are funded by taxes. Did any in the United States, when radio was in its infancy, did anyone question following the pattern established by telegraph and telephone, or was there not even any sort of discussion about it?
Well, I just want to emphasize the government did play a very important part in radio. It didn't just leave it to the private sector. It made absolutely critical decisions about the allocation of the airwaves. The key question of, well, who would get the right to to use the airwaves and under what rules. And at first, there was a kind of wide-open situation in the airwaves. There was no sense in the early 1920s, as radio first developed, that there would be a significant problem of signal interference. But by the mid to late 20s, it became apparent that not everybody could just automatically get a license and start a radio station, especially as the stations got stronger, as the signals got stronger. And so by the late 1920s, the federal government, this is in 1927, stepped in with the first of the major radio regulation acts. And, yeah, there was a great deal of debate about how radio should work, and many different ideas about how it could be financed. There was initially a great prejudice against any advertising, and I shouldn't call it a prejudice. There were just people who thought it would be terrible if radio worked on the basis of advertising. But there wasn't any willingness to tax people to support radio. Here we come back to the anti-tax views that Americans have, because what happened in Britain and elsewhere is that, in fact, taxes were adopted. In Britain, a special earmarked tax on every radio that went to support what became the BBC. But there was no significant support for that in the United States. So the big dispute here was really about the allocation of the airwaves, who would get the right to operate the stations. And the criteria that were adopted by what was first called the Federal Radio Commission and then the FCC, those criteria tended to favor the commercial radio stations that had better financing. And how could they get that except through advertising? And so the system gravitated toward an advertising basis.
As you say, perhaps the big difference between something like broadcasting and print is that the broadcast spectrum is finite, and a town could have as many newspapers as it wanted, but you can't have as many radio stations as you want unless you want to deal with a whole lot of interference issues. So there had to be some sort of regulation about who could broadcast at what frequency, what kind of range, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And remember, this is before FM radio. This is when there was only AM, and when the technology was much more limited. And so the number of stations that could be supported, that could fill the airwaves, the number was much, much smaller than is on AM today.
Right.
So it was much more limited.
One issue that that some people in broadcasting think is important, but in recent years we seem to have gotten away from, is this idea that the broadcast spectrum is not any one individual's property. It is the public's property, and that in exchange for using the spectrum to make money, broadcasters were expected to do some kind of public service. I think we've virtually completely abandoned that idea now, but there was at one time when that was a little bit stronger idea than is now. How did that come about, or was that at all a controversial idea?
Well, yes, it was, and it really came about in the late 1930s and 40s. And this was related to the New Deal. Because there's sort of one element here to fill in, and that is the development of the commercial radio networks in the late 1920s and 30s. These were originally NBC and CBS, and they grew to a dominant position in radio broadcasting in that period. And originally, they did not have any significant commitment to news, to journalism. And in fact, the newspapers were very anxious that radio not get into the news. And there was for a while an agreement between the networks and the newspaper publishers that news would be limited to just 5 minutes and would end with a word that listeners should check their local newspapers for more details. So there was originally very little sort of news public issue commitment in radio, but during the 1930s, that began to change, and it began to change partly because of a competition for prestige between NBC and CBS, and with the events that were happening in Europe in the late 30s, and then of course in the 40s, people became extremely interested in what was going on in the wider world. And radio reporting from Europe during the war, of course, Edward R. Murrow and so forth, really became the takeoff point for broadcast journalism, for serious broadcast journalism and serious discussion of public affairs on the radio. And then during the 1940s, the Federal Communications Commission began to focus on this area. In the late 1940s, we had the introduction of what was called the Fairness Doctrine, which said that that radio stations had to devote a significant amount of time to public affairs, and they had to have a balanced presentation of those issues. And, of course, that lasted until the Reagan administration, 1987, when the FCC dropped the Fairness Doctrine. And that has had, of course, tremendous consequences for the development of talk radio in the years since.
Yeah. We have a caller here. I want to bring them into the conversation, and perhaps I'll introduce again our guest for
sure.
Anyone who might have just tuned in. We're talking with Paul Starr. He's professor of sociology at Princeton. He is co-editor of The American Prospect. He is the author of a book that won the Pulitzer Prize in 1984 for general nonfiction. That book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, a very well-received book, and also a new book that deals with the subject we're talking about here this morning. It's titled The Creation of the Media, Political Origins of Modern Communications, and it's published by Basic Books. Questions are welcome. We have a couple of people here ready to go. In Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have someone to talk with here in Kankakee in line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
At some point during the conversation, would you please let us know what your understanding of the history of the media leads you to say about the Internet? Thank you.
Well, that's a good question. You want to talk about that?
Oh, I'd be delighted. In some ways, of course, the Internet reproduces the early history of the post office. The Internet started off as a federally sponsored communications network, but it was also a network where there was a very low level of control, and so it was not used for purposes of surveillance. It was set up to originally to enable military and scientific communication. Then it got opened up for commercial use, then turned over completely to the private sector. So it has tremendously facilitated private exchange, just the way the post office did, and it was the government that played a crucial role in getting it started. So I think in many ways it recapitulates the early history of the post office. Now, of course, the Internet, I mean, everybody a few years ago was saying the Internet changes everything, and there was this sense of euphoria. And I think it will have extraordinary implications for almost everything that we do. I don't, however, believe that it's just a matter of the technology working itself out. I think there are crucial questions of law here, and that we couldn't really expect, as some people did, that the Internet would be this realm of freedom from law, that it would just be an area where anybody could do whatever they wanted, because we face all these problems that people are now so aware of, problems of fraud, the viruses and so forth. Unfortunately, we need a system of law. A system of law rooted, however, in our Constitution, in our Bill of Rights, that guarantees us these rights, but that also assures protection against the unfortunate problem that follows us everywhere. That some people will be malicious. That some people will use the technology for fraudulent purposes, and so forth. And so, I think we're just in the process of working out what the rules are going to be. And unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be quite as freewheeling as it was in its early days. Hmm.
Let's talk with another caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering if in your courses at Princeton, how do you handle what I take to be the biggest story involving the media, and that is the looking at the media as the vehicle for propaganda, because you talk about government versus advertisers as being, you know, in partnership with the communications industry, but you haven't made the further step of stating that because advertisers are because the media is so dependent on advertisers can promote profit-making of various kinds over the common good much more easily. And it all has to do with propaganda. In particular, I'm thinking of like what Alex Carey and Harold Lasswell had to say about propaganda. Harold Lasswell, for example, said with the decline of the authority of the crown, the church, and social class, propaganda is the principal means of social control. And another thing that Alex Carey talked about was how because of the vote being afforded to a greater percentage of people between 1880 and 1920, that was another reason why the communications industry got bent into a vehicle of social control. And could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. I think we try to have several protections against propaganda. One is the diversity of the press and the potential for different voices to serve as a correction. It's not all unanimous out there. There is a lot of debate. And secondly, there's professionalism in the news media. And as faulty as that may sometimes be, it is also something that we rely on. The integrity of reporters, the concern that people have for their reputation, that's also a basis for resisting propaganda. It's an imperfect world, but I think those are two best defenses, as well as the very healthy skepticism and cynicism of the public. People know that they are the target of advertising and propaganda, and they discount a lot of what they hear. One of the discoveries of the very earliest research in the sociology of the media is that people are not as susceptible to influence as was thought. In fact, people are pretty stubborn. They have their view of the world, often a view that they formed early in life, and it is not very easy to change it. And this idea that the media could simply inject, in fact, used to be called the hypodermic theory of the media, that the media could simply inject an idea, an attitude, and people would be changed accordingly. That's a myth. It's actually very, very hard to shift public opinion.
Well, I would disagree, but to point out the way Alex Carey develops his argument, he was talking about in World War One how Wilson got the public involved in going to war, and then the corporations saw the the way his propaganda changed the public attitude, and they used it in the steel strike of 1919, and they actually from a beginning a point where the public was sympathetic to the steel strike. They were working like 84-hour weeks in the most atrocious conditions. They actually turned everything around so that the people were against the steel strike, and the steel strike was a failure. And you know, there's a lot to be said for Alex Carey's argument, but I've taken up enough time. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know, Professor Starr, you want to talk anything more about that?
Well, World War One was a crisis, provoked a crisis of confidence in the news media, because there's no question that the Wilson administration not only engaged in a massive propaganda effort itself, but it also did manipulate the press. And in the aftermath of the war, Walter Lippmann and others saw a need for journalists to establish a much stronger sense of professionalism and independence, and I think that experience was really crucial in the formation of the sense of journalistic professionalism that I think has been a very significant counterforce to the kinds of influences that the caller mentions.
All right, let's go to Chicago for another caller, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. It seems to me that you're contradicting yourself, because you said that the media cannot be used as propaganda because people form their impressions very early and they aren't swayed from those thoughts. But we all know that children are watching TV from almost infancy, and that there are also studies that say that children can't differentiate between commercial and documentary TV, so it all runs into one blur for them. They can't distinguish. And we also know that many schools have been encouraged to use television in the classroom, so that there is a very strong propaganda effect that we have as a country, along with your thesis saying that things are determined for political means, we have allowed to go ahead without analyzing how our children are being propagandized, why our children need to watch TV in the classroom rather than at home during their leisure hours. So I guess I've seen a lot of contradiction in your argument, because you're almost arguing for what the other caller said, that television clearly has and is and will be used as a propaganda force in our society, mainly for the precise reason that you wrote your book. You wrote your book to prove how the political our political agenda was determined our media, but it's also determining our political beliefs now.
Well, I guess I don't see the contradiction. I don't deny that many people try to use the media to influence the public, and in some cases they do succeed. What I was saying to the other caller, and we'll say again, is just I don't think people are puppets. I don't think they are so easily manipulated. I think you're right, however, that the children present a very special case, and you know, I think there are good reasons for parents to regulate the kinds of things their kids watch, precisely for that reason. On the other hand, I wouldn't want the media censored in line with what children need, because I think that's you know, that would reduce all of us to the limits of a children's library. I mean, that's always been the argument for regulation of obscenity and indecency, and we had a long struggle over that in this country as to whether the standards would be set on the basis of what children should hear and watch and read, or what adults could watch and read and so forth. And so I'm very reluctant to set children as a benchmark here, as the point of reference for thinking about what the media should be like.
No, I wasn't using it as a benchmark. I was using it to concur with your point that if an idea is set at childhood, it will remain. And I'm saying that television does propagandize to children, and therefore you have adults who are already indoctrinated, and the process was never monitored by any social agency because we just allowed it to happen because children were just being taught in the classroom. And I think the other point is that I don't think we need to be concerned about our television or media being censored. What we have to worry about is the self-censorship, the failure of the media to be diverse. I mean, I don't see the this diversity that you see. Basically, I feel that we get very little news compared to the rest of the world. I just read a report that a German television had a report on the torture in Al-Assad prison in Iraq. I never heard that, and I have yet to hear that on any other media. I'm not sure if you have. So our danger is the fact that we believe that we have a free press, and so we assume that we're getting all the information, and instead we have a press that has been very happy to censor itself for whatever reasons. Sometimes they say it's time constraints and they can't look at all the sources. I don't know what their reasons are, but the fact is that it does censor itself, and we have a public that probably could make decisions if they had all the news, but we don't. And so I'm a little alarmed that people continue on with the myth of the diversity of our media, or even that it's not being censored for economic reasons, if not political reasons. And I really hope that you would not continue on with these myths, because it's very important that we are at least aware of what's happening.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call. I don't know, Professor Starr, again, if you want to take that any further.
Well, I think there are some serious problems with concentration of media ownership. So there are some areas where I think diversity is at risk. But I'm afraid I disagree. I still believe there is a tremendous diversity of sources of information. I think there are problems with the performance of news organizations. The New York Times recently has had to admit that its reporting about weapons of mass destruction was seriously defective, and they gave far too much credibility to sources that have proven to be erroneous. There are many reasons, I think, to be skeptical about specific problems and errors that have been made, but I have more confidence. I think it's a continuing struggle to get a good reading, especially on breaking news, where it's hard to know what's right and what's wrong. I mean, maybe this caller mentions a new scandal of prison abuse in Iraq reported by a German paper. Maybe it's true and maybe it isn't. I don't know.
Well, just if indeed we are concerned and have reason to be concerned about some of the things that we've talked about, including perhaps the backing away from the idea that broadcasters, at least, have some responsibility for public service, and if we are concerned about the increasing concentration of media ownership broadly across the spectrum of media, and the fact that, among other things, that means that things that people regard as their local media are often not locally owned. If we're concerned about those kinds of things, then what do we do about that?
Well, push for some legislative changes. Congress, I believe, should rewrite the 1996 Telecommunications Act to provide stronger guarantees of media diversity. For example, to reinstate certain limits on radio station ownership that were removed in 1996. There used to be a cap on the number of stations that a single company could own. That was taken off, and of course we've had the emergence of these huge radio companies, so that there are two companies now that control more than 70% of the revenue in the commercial radio industry. That's certainly something to be concerned about. The Federal Communications Commission is now considering some rules that have to do with cable-carrying broadcast stations. And there is a rule that currently requires cable companies to carry local broadcast stations. And a number of people are proposing, and I think this is a very good idea, that broadcast stations have to have a certain minimum amount of public affairs programming in order to qualify for this benefit, because the stations benefit from having cable carry them. And I think there are a whole series of areas where there are legitimate grounds for getting federal regulation to support a greater diversity of expression. And let me just bring this whole discussion sort of for a full circle,
mm-hmm.
because you started out by talking, by asking me about the American Revolution and the early development of the post office. I think those policies that were set in the early republic promoted a tremendous variety of viewpoints, of expression. The postal benefits, the subsidies to newspapers that enabled newspapers to be circulated very widely, those were given to all newspapers regardless of viewpoint. And that helped create a very lively sphere of public debate. And we need that same kind of policy that is that supports a great diversity of expression in the United States. I think public broadcasting, by the way, is part of that. And I think, to mention another policy, I think it would be an excellent decision if we took some of the proceeds from sales of the radio spectrum, because spectrum has been sold off in recent decades, and we created an endowment for public broadcasting out of that, out of those spectrum sales. That would also help, again, support a diversity of different voices, because that's what we need in order for the public to come to a reasonable decision about political matters.
All right, there we will have to stop as we're at the end of the time. Our guest, Paul Starr, his book is The Creation of the Media. He is professor of sociology at Princeton. The book is published by Basic Books. Professor Starr, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Our show, broadcast today, made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Art Mart, Art Mart Toys, Callaway Clothing, Calico Jewelry, and Tang Dynasty Restaurant. The program also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards. That's it for us in Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with an orthopedic surgeon about bones. We'll talk with him about keeping our bones healthy. Dr. Leon Root will be our guest. He is the author of Beautiful Bones Without Hormones. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. July wheat, 364, that's down 6. September, 374 and a quarter, down 6 and a quarter. July corn, 3 1/4, that down 8. September corn, 301, down 8 1/2. December corn, 302, down 8 3/4. March corn, 307 1/4, down 7 3/4.